Well, thanks. It's good to be here, and I'm really glad Gilbert put together this session, and it looks like a great session, and I look forward to all of the talks. I'll be talking about the microbiological aspects of animal waste management and animal waste management systems and how they help us to mitigate issues, a lot of the issues that we have, and how the new applications help us to understand more. I figured since I was the first person, I wouldn't be going wrong to put in a little information about livestock animal production, or manure production. As I'm sure most of the people in the audience know, animal production has shifted in the last 50 or so years to concentrated animal feeding operations, and so that's also concentrated the amount of manures that we have. USDA estimates 300 million tons of animal manure dry weight per year, and then you see all of these numbers like 13 times to 130 times as much animal waste as human waste. Regardless of what it is, there's a lot of animal manure out there, and it needs to be utilized to its maximum benefit. And I always put in that graphic showing the amount of manure produced by different animals, and you can look at the chicken and think he's all innocent there with his 0.14 pounds per day, but you multiply that by 10 or 20,000 chickens in a house, by multiple houses on a farm, and you're talking about a lot of chicken manure production, so nobody's innocent in this story for sure. So manure is a valuable resource, and throughout eons in time, it's always been recognized as such, used for crop fertilization and soil conditioning. And so our goals are really to just try to use the manure to its benefit and mitigate the negative consequences for air, soil, and water resources. My focus today is on incorporating the microbial ecology into animal waste management, or understanding animal waste management systems. So historically, everyone's focused on chemical measurements, physical measurements, which makes perfect sense, and it's vitally important, right? I mean, it doesn't actually, it's important to know there's ammonia. It's good to know what the microbiology is of that, and hopefully by the end you'll see why understanding the microbiology helps with understanding and mitigating the processes. But now, with the advent of the molecular techniques, we've really come a long way in terms of what the micro can contribute. In the past, there's been a lot of culturing, and I'm sure even non-microbiologists have heard the whole less than 1% of organisms are culturable. It's just an artificial situation, vitally, vitally important, but still an artificial situation that's created on a plate. It also is like meticulous and time-consuming. So here you're getting physical measurements and chemical measurements coming out of your eyeballs, and the microbiologist is going to get you data soon, you know. So it's taken some time for the microbiology to catch up, and molecular techniques have really helped with that in the last, I'd say several decades. However, in the time that I've been around watching in the last 10 to 15 years, these things go from medical applications, some regulatory applications, and then the environmental people scraping off the bottom of the barrel start trying to apply it to our situations. And we've really been able to come a long way. And I come from a NASA background, so we make anagrams for everything, right? But these samples are dirty, they're complex, but we've really been able to start applying cleanup mechanisms, high throughput mechanisms. So now we can get good samples, a lot of data, and really contribute to the physical and chemical data that people are getting out of these systems to understand the entire environment. And the moral of this story and the take-home message is definitely interdisciplinary research. Almost every single study, if not every study that I do, is in collaboration with soil scientists, chemists, microbiologists, because that's the way you truly understand systems and come to solutions. I wanted to start with something that I work on a little bit, but this is definitely not directly related to my work. But this is one of the ways to illustrate how paradigm shifts happening in the microbiological community have implications for agriculture, wastewater treatment, human and livestock wastewater treatment. So ammonia oxidation, the first and limiting process in nitrification, where ammonia is converted to nitrite. When you were coming up in my age, you were told it's an aerobic bacterial process. very limited number of bugs, and that's just how it is. And that's because it was based on culturing, you know, and chemical data. Well, then in the mid-90s, wastewater treatment people started seeing that they were getting a lot of ammonia oxidation and in their anaerobic systems. And then they were able to isolate these planktomycetes, and there's still a kind of a black box population that we're just now learning more about. But they're extremely important population. For one thing, they're being applied to waste livestock and human wastewater treatment, and Mateus Venati will be talking about how we're applying it to livestock waste treatments. And also, they think that over 40% of nitrogen loss in marine environments is due to anammox. So this isn't just a small change that's happened, it's a paradigm shift, right? The same way with ammonia oxidizing bacteria, and that's only happened in the last 10 and 15 years, and really based on molecular data where people started going to look into their soils and they were looking for ammonia oxidizing bacteria, and they found that instead they were archaea. And then we've had this big thing happening nowadays that there's more archaeal ammonia oxidizers than there are bacterial. And I saw a really good talk by Peter Bottomley on Monday about the cautionary tale, which is the molecular analysis are often DNA based, and so these are the organisms that are present. This is why you need the interdisciplinary research. So if you find you're getting 10 times the bacteria as you're getting, you know, the correlation to ammonia oxidation, then you need to start questioning what it really means. But regardless, these two things have really shaken how we think about ammonia oxidation, and have implications not just for the microbiological thinking, but for all of the environmental research. I'm going the wrong way. Okay, this is some of my research on poultry litter, and just as an example of how understanding the microbiology kind of at the very least, adds to our understanding of what's going on in the systems. So everybody probably is aware that ammonia is a problem in poultry production, decreased performance, it's a safety issue. In my mind, by far, I think that the loss of the nitrogen value in the litter, and as, you know, economic issues increase, that becomes even more of an issue. So our goal was to try to understand what the microbiology was involved in this system, which is surprising how little was known. A good amount known about the chemistry, not as much about the microbiology. And this is a microbial process, right? Uric acid is 70% of the nitrogen in poultry litter. By uricase and several other enzymes, it's converted to urea, and then that, through urease, is converted to ammonia. So if you can deal with the microbiology of the system, you may be able to improve your nitrogen retention. We started by looking at acidification, because I'm horrified by liming litter. But acidifiers, increase the amount of ammonia that's retained in your litter. They work beautifully, and the chemistry of them is pretty well understood, but the microbiology was really not understood at all. So our question is, was there some correlation in what's happening in the microbiology as well as in the chemistry? And, I know it's a busy site, but the moral of the story definitely is that obviously there's a chemical aspect, but there's also a huge microbiological aspect. So this is normal litter. An acidified litter, this is a lab-based study, so it's not what you're going to probably see in a house, just hopefully an example. This is sampling time, and the yellow line is organic nitrogen hydrolyzed, and the red line is fungi, and the green line is bacteria. In normal litter, you very quickly lose your nitrogen, very well known, and this is change in population. Change in populations, and so what we saw is a doubling, tripling of the microbial population that produces urease and uricase. Not a huge surprise. Most importantly is the fact that those bugs are there, they're ready to go, and they're going to utilize that very, very quickly. Fungi, just not a factor in normal litter. I mean, barely present, right? Then you acidify the litter, put your pH down, you have a delayed response, which you always see in ammonia production in acidified litter. And what we saw is a huge decrease, and especially in the microbial populations that produce urease and uricase, which is amazing because there's a lot of bugs in litter. So pH changes truly affect the microbial population in amazing ways. But what you do is you open up a niche, right? So if you lose one kind of bug, you're going to gain another kind of bug guaranteed, because there's somebody to do almost everything in the microbial world. So what we see is this insane increase in the fungal population. And Mike Rothrock was my postdoc. He's now in Athens, Georgia, and he was able to show that this increase in fungal population correlates really nicely with mineralization of the nitrogen in poultry litter. So if you can do something about the fungal bloom in acidified litter, then you may be able to decrease even more, maybe not eliminate ammonia production, but increase the nitrogen retained. And I have way too many slides here, so I'm not going to go into detail on this, except for to say we started trying to look at some novel ways to decrease either the fungal bloom or to decrease the amount of nitrogen based on a kind of a microbial approach. And mainly what we found is using anything in poultry litter, acidifiers, nitrification inhibitors, acidifiers plus even a microbiological product, which I was surprised about. But we found this chitosan, which we're going to do more research on. It's a very inexpensive, highly available product, nonspecific adsorbent, and it did a beautiful job. And used with acidifiers, we may be able to get rid of some of our issues with the fungal blooms. But that's just one way to try to put a point across the point that understanding the microbiology has vastly increased our understanding of why something's been working for us and improved our ability to move that information forward. This stuff is, I just want another word about like something fundamental, like pathogens and indicators. And probably all of you are aware, like an indicator is just a bug that tells you there may be possible contamination, human contamination or livestock contamination, just fecal contamination present. And so we base that largely on E. coli, right, or traditional fecal indicators, because very well-known organism, genetics are well worked out, very culturable organism, easy to work with. So it's been the gold standard in our world. It's also, easy to get on a plate, right? So that, in a way, that it's kind of become entrenched even in the microbiologist way of thinking. And I know I'm passing over a lot of stuff, but what I wanted to show here is these are the presence of a lot of pathogens and indicators in either poultry litter or dairy manure. The first thing I want to point out, and I remember when I first went to Bowling Green and Kara Matsustani was telling me he wanted me to work with poultry litter, and I'm like, I worked with swine manure and dairy, and they have a lot of bacteria. You would expect them to have a lot of bacteria. There's nothing like poultry litter. I mean, 10 to the 10 cells per gram of litter. You should see it moving in your hand, I swear to God. But it is amazing stuff. And if you have pathogens in your litter, like if you have campy, you have a lot of campy. Or you don't have it at all. I've never seen a little bit of campy or a little bit of salmonella. And the same way, though, with, for example, enterococci. I just show this because it's amazing that these two numbers work out. I know in chemistry y'all do a lot, but never in micro. But very similar concentrations to the pathogen, which is what you would want to see, easier to work with. People are moving a good bit to enterococci. E. coli is not in poultry litter. I mean, everybody else, I've actually plated poultry litter on selective media, which are very good, well-developed for E. coli, and had nothing grow the next day. So 10 of the 10th cells, and the next day I've got nothing on a plate. There's just not E. coli in poultry litter. So if you're using it as an indicator, if you're trying to understand the safety of something based on some traditional indicator like E. coli, it's not legitimate for poultry litter, more so for dairy manure. And then you have the issues like, I show that that's the concentration of campy, but once that went into the soil and we're trying to monitor it and doing some of our work, you don't pick it up except for through enrichment. So the indicators are very important because the pathogens are very picky. The indicators aren't picky. This is a study that we did in swine lagoon slurry. These are the total cells and then three different potential indicators of fecal contamination. These samples were taken over the course of a year, and these are concentrations. So you have about 10 to the 8th cells per gram at the top of a swine lagoon. you have about 10 to the 7th an order of magnitude lower bacteroides. People don't like them as an indicator because they are anaerobes, so you have to use real-time PCR. They're not something you culture, but there's something, people are more reluctant to use it just because it's using new techniques. But this is what you're getting if you're looking for the E. coli. I think this is a good illustration of what you're talking about in terms of your population you're targeting if you're trying to look for E. coli in these environments. Now, this is just a cool thing that I'm doing with Western Kentucky University with Becky Gilfellin and Nestle Nethwatsigi, and I totally blew his name, but he's awesome, and he's doing great work in linking GPS monitoring and GIS analysis and taking the molecular data, chemical data, and physical data and doing these geospatial maps, which I've seen a lot more of this and talked to more people that are doing this kind of work, where we took a feedlot that's kind of on a downhill gradient and looked at the feed area, grass areas, a retention basin, and then a sinkhole. And these are all on the same kind of scales, but just based on concentration. And this is, Nestle will talk later about the all of the other data. But we were looking at total cells, indicator bacteroides, indicator in form of enterococci, or E. coli. Well, you would expect to see, you know, not a lot of change in total cells. That's generally the case, except for in really concentrated areas. The bacteroides reflect a lot more what you would expect to see in terms of where there would be fecal contamination. In the feedlot area, in the top feeder area, and in the retention basin area where the animals congregate a lot. You also saw that trend in the enterococci. But then when you get to the E. coli, what you find is that it doesn't reflect the changes as much, but also your dynamic range, because your concentrations are so low, is not nearly as good. So you don't have as much room for error in terms of trying to use it as a monitoring tool. But the main take-home from this, and you'll see when you see in Nestle's data, and I've seen it in other talks, is the way that you can put the microbiology in with large field scale and chemical data and come up with a real picture of what's going on in the system now. So that's excellent, rather than just a bunch of numbers or a bunch of names of bugs. Finally, I really wanted to focus in on the fact that these interdisciplinary approaches where you're incorporating the microbiology and the chemistry are going to be invaluable moving forward. We're going to find new things, which we already are, about antibiotic-resistant genes, distribution, greenhouse gas, nitrogen cycling, and important things like mycorrhizal fungi, which we're understanding the importance of them and using molecular techniques is just adding to our ability to do that. And, just pointing out huge number of collaborators and the fact that it's interdisciplinary research that helps me really get to the actual answers and applied ways to some of the solutions to these problems. Thank you very much.
We have time for a few questions. Any questions?
Wow. I can't believe I actually got done in time.
Reducing the pH. What about using alum?
Well, we used alum, poultry guard. We used most of the different kinds of acidifiers for acidification in the poultry litter. Yeah, and it works brilliantly. Actually, there's been a lot of studies to show that pH is probably, over environment and geography, the major driver of microbial populations around the world. And based on what I've seen happening in poultry litter with acidification, I definitely believe that.
So does it affect the microbes?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that massively affects the microbial population. Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah, Bill?
Do you have a physiological explanation why E. coli is so low in poultry litter as opposed to the other?
I just don't. And at first I thought that it was just me, and then I think some other people have done the same kind of work, and they've been amazed, too, that they haven't been able to get it. The one thing that I can, it's dominated by a lot of gram positives, and it's really harsh environment. But on top of that, with it being so concentrated, it's also competitive environment. But who has known E. coli not to compete? So, I'm kind of amazed by it. I really am.
Yeah.